temper. "Then I sentence you to 6 months. Take the prisoner down." "Thank you, my lord," said Pat, and added under his breath, "See you this time next year." The bailiff hustled Pat out of the dock and quickly down the stairs to the basement.
"Nice one, Pat,"
he said, before locking him back up in a holding cell. Pat remained in the holding cell while he waited for all the necessary forms to be filled in. Several hours passed before the cell door was finally opened and he was escorted out of the courthouse to his waiting transport. Not on this occasion a panda car driven by Sergeant Webster, but a long blue-and-white van with a dozen tiny cubicles inside, known as the sweatbox.
"Where are they taking me this time?"
Pat asked a not very communicative officer whom he'd never seen before.
"You'll find out when you get there, Paddy," was all he got in reply.
"Have I ever told you about the time I tried to get a job in a building site in Liverpool?"
"No," replied the officer. "And I don't want to hear."
"And the foreman, a bloody Englishman, had the nerve to ask me if I knew the difference between..."
Pat was shoved up the steps of the van and pushed into a little cubicle that resembled a lavatory on a plane. He fell onto the plastic seat as the door was slammed behind him. Pat stared out of the tiny square window and, when the vehicle turned south onto Baker Street, realized it had to be Belmarsh. Pat sighed.
"At least they've got a half-decent library," he thought. "And I may even be able to get my old job back in the kitchen."
When the Black Maria pulled up outside the prison gates, his guess was confirmed. A large green board attached to the prison gate announced Belmarsh, and some wag had replaced Bell with Hell. The van proceeded through one set of double-barred gates and then another, before finally coming to a halt in a barren yard. 12 prisoners were herded out of the van and marched up the steps to an induction area where they waited in line. Pat smiled when he reached the front of the queue and saw who was behind the desk checking them all in.
"And how are we this fine pleasant evening, Mr. Jenkins?" Pat asked.
The senior officer looked up from behind his desk and said,
"It can't be October already."
"It most certainly is, Mr. Jenkins," Pat confirmed. "And may I offer my commiserations on your recent loss?"
"My recent loss?" repeated Mr. Jenkins. "What are you talking about, Pat?"
"Those 15 Welshmen who appeared in Dublin earlier this year, passing themselves off as a rugby team."
"Don't put your luck, Pat."
"But I, Mr. Jenkins, when I was hoping that you would allocate me my old cell."
The SO ran his finger down the list of available cells.
"Afraid not, Pat," he said with an exaggerated sigh. "It's already double booked, but I've got just the person for you to spend your first night with," he added before turning to the night officer. "Why don't you escort O'Flynn to cell 119?
The night officer looked uncertain, but after a further look from Mr. Jenkins, all he said was,
"Follow me, Pat."
"So who has Mr. Jenkins selected to be my pad mate on this occasion?" inquired Pat,
as the night officer accompanied him down the long grey brick corridor before coming to a halt at the first set of double-barred gates.
"Is it to be Jack the Ripper or Michael Jackson?"
"You'll find out soon enough,"
responded the night officer as the second of the barred gates slid open.
"Have I ever told you,"
asked Pat as they walked out onto the ground floor of B Block,
"about the time I tried to get a job on a building site in Liverpool and the foreman, a bloody Englishman, had the nerve to ask me if I knew the difference between a joist and a girder?"
Pat waited for the officer to respond as they came to a halt outside cell number 119. He placed a large key in the lock.
"No, Pat, you haven't," the night officer said as he pulled open the heavy door. "So what is the difference between a joist and a girder?" he demanded.
Pat was about to reply, but when he looked into the cell, was momentarily silenced.
"Good evening, my lord,"
said Pat, for the second time that day. The night officer didn't wait for a reply. He slammed the door closed and turned the key in the lock. Pat spent the rest of the evening telling me, in graphic detail, all that had taken place since 2 o'clock that morning. When he had finally come to the end of his tale, I simply asked, "Why October?"
"Once the clocks go back," said Pat, "I prefer to be inside where I'm guaranteed 3 meals a day in a cell with central heating. Sleeping rough is all very well in the summer, but it's not so clever during an English winter.
But what would you have done if Mr. Perkins had sentenced you to a year? I asked.
I'd have been on my best behaviour from day one, said Pat, and they would have released me in 6 months. They have a real problem with overcrowding at the moment, he explained.
But if Mr. Perkins had stuck to his original sentence of just 3 months, you'd have been released in January, midwinter.
Not a hope, said Pat. Just before I was due to be let out, I would have been found with a bottle of Guinness in my cell, a misdemeanour for which the governor is obliged to automatically add a further 3 months to your sentence, and that would have taken me comfortably through to April.
I laughed. And is that how you intend to spend the rest of your life? I asked.
I don't think that far ahead, admitted Pat. 6 months is quite enough to be going on with, he added, as he climbed onto the top bunk and switched off the light.
Good night, Pat, I said, as I rested my head on the pillow.
Have I ever told you about the time I tried to get a job on a building site in Liverpool? Asked Pat, just as I was falling asleep.
No, you haven't, I replied.
Well, the foreman, a bloody Englishman, no offence intended, I smiled, had the nerve to ask me if I knew the difference between a joist and a girder.
And do you? I asked.
I most certainly do. Joyce wrote Ulysses and Goethe wrote Faust.
Patrick O'Flynn died of hypothermia on the 23rd of November 2005 while sleeping under the arches on Victoria Embankment in central London. His body was discovered by a young constable just 100 yards away from the Savoy Hotel. 5. The Red King.
They charged me with the wrong offence and sentenced me for the wrong crime, Max said as he lay in the bunk below me, rolling another cigarette.
While I was in prison, I heard this claim voiced by inmates on several occasions, but in the case of Max Glover, it turned out to be true. Max was serving a 3-year sentence for obtaining money by false pretences. Not his game. Max's speciality was removing small items from large homes. He once told me, with considerable professional pride, that it could be years before an owner became aware that a family heirloom has gone missing, especially, Max added, if you take one small but valuable object from a cluttered room.
Mind you, continued Max, I'm not complaining because if they had charged me with the crime I did commit, I would have ended up with a much longer sentence. He paused. And nothing to look forward to once I'm released.
Max knew he had aroused my curiosity, and as I had nowhere to go for the next 3 hours before the cell door would be opened for association, that glorious 45 minutes when prisoners are allowed out of their cell for a stroll around the yard, I picked up my pen and said, "Okay, Max, I'm hooked. So, tell me how you came to be sentenced for the wrong crime." Max struck a match, lit his hand-rolled cigarette and inhaled deeply before he began. In prison, every action is exaggerated, as no one is in a hurry. I lay on the bunk above and waited patiently.
"Does the Kennington set mean anything to you?" Max began.
"No," I replied, assuming he must be referring to a group of red-coated gentlemen on horseback, glass of port in one hand, whip in the other, surrounded by a pack of hounds with intent to spend their Saturday morning in pursuit of a furry animal with a bushy tail. I was wrong. The Kennington set, as Max went on to explain, was in fact a chess set.
"But no ordinary chess set," he assured me.
I became more interested. The pieces were probably crafted by Lu Ping, 1469 to 1540, a master craftsman of the Ming Dynasty, 1368 to 1644. All 32 ivory pieces were exquisitely carved and then delicately painted in red and white. The details have been faithfully recorded in several historic documents, though it has never been conclusively established exactly how many sets Lu Ping was responsible for producing in his lifetime. Three complete sets were known to be in existence, continued Max as smoke spiraled up from the lower bunk. The first is displayed in the throne room of the People's Palace in Peking, the second in the Mellon Collection in Washington, and the third at the British Museum. Many collectors scoured the great continent of China in search of the fabled fourth set, and although such efforts always ended in failure, several individual pieces appeared on the market from time to time. Max stubbed out the smallest cigarette butt I have ever seen. I was at that time, continued Max, carrying out some research into the smaller objects of Kennington Hall in Yorkshire. How did you manage that? I asked. Country Life commissioned Lord Kennington to write a coffee table book for Christmas in which he detailed the treasures of Kennington Hall, Max said before rolling a second cigarette. Most considerate of him, he added. Among the peer's ancestors was one James Kennington, 1552 to 1618, a true adventurer, buccaneer, and loyal servant of Queen Elizabeth I. James rescued the first set in 1588, only moments before he sunk the Isabella. On returning to Plymouth, following a 17-4 victory in the match against the Spanish, Captain Kennington lavished treasure plundered from the sinking ship on his monarch. Her Majesty always showed a great deal of interest in anything solid, especially if she could wear it, gold, silver, pearls, or rare gems, and rewarded Captain Kennington with a knighthood. Elizabeth had no use for the chess set, so Sir James was stuck with it. Unlike Sir Francis or Sir Walter, Sir James continued to plunder the high seas. He was so successful that a decade later his monarch elevated him to the House of Lords, with the title the First Lord Kennington, for services rendered to the crown. Max paused before adding, "The only difference between a pirate and a peer is who you divide the spoils with." The second Lord Kennington, like his monarch, showed no interest in chess, so the set was left to gather dust in one of the 92 rooms in Kennington Hall. As there were few historical incidents worthy of mention during the uneventful lives of the 3rd, 4th, 5th, or 6th Lords Kennington, we can only assume that the remarkable chess set remained in situ. Its pieces never moved in anger. The 7th Lord Kennington served as a colonel in the 12th Light Dragoons at the time of Waterloo. The colonel played the occasional game of chess, so the set was dusted down and returned to the long gallery. The 8th Lord Kennington was slaughtered during the charge of the Light Brigade, the 9th in the Boer War, and the 10th at Ypres. The 11th, a playboy, led a more peaceful life, but eventually found it necessary for pecuniary reasons. Kennington Hall required a new roof to open his home to the public. They turned up every weekend in countless numbers, and for a small sum were allowed to stroll around the hall. When they ventured into the long gallery, they came across the Chinese masterpiece on its stand, surrounded by a red rope. With mounting debts which the public's entrance fees could not offset, the 11th Lord Kennington was forced to sell off several of the family heirlooms, including the Kennington set. Christie's placed an estimate of £100,000 on the masterpiece, but the auctioneer's hammer finally fell at $230,000. When you next visit Washington, added Max between puffs, you can view the original Kennington set as it's now part of the Mellon collection. This would have been the end of my tale, continued Max, if the 11th Lord Kennington hadn't married an American striptease artiste who gave birth to a son. This child displayed a quality that the Kennington lineage had not troubled themselves with for several generations. Brains. The Honourable Harry Kennington became, much to the disapproval of his father, a hedge fund manager, and thus the natural heir to the first Lord Kennington. He was a man who took as easily to the currency market as his pirate ancestors had to the high seas. By the age of 27, Harry had plundered his first million as an asset stripper, much to his mother's amusement, who suggested that stripping was clearly a hereditary trait. By the time Harry inherited the title, he was chairman of Kennington's bank. The first thing he did with his newfound wealth was to set about restoring Kennington Hall to its former glory. He certainly did not allow members of the public to pay £5 to park their cars on his front lawn. The 12th Lord Kennington like his father, also married a remarkable woman. Elsie Trumpshaw was the offspring of a Yorkshire cotton mill proprietor and the product of a Cheltenham ladies' college education. Like any self-respecting Yorkshire lass, Elsie considered the saying, "If you take care of the pennies, the pounds will take care of themselves," to be a creed, not a cliché. While her husband was away making money, Elsie was unquestionably the mistress of Kennington Hall. Having spent her formative years wearing her elder sister's hand-me-downs, carrying her thumbed books to school and later borrowing her lipstick, whatever the colour, Elsie was well qualified to be the guardian of a hereditary pile. With consummate skill, diligence and good housekeeping, she set about the maintenance and upkeep of the newly restored hall. Although she had no interest in the game of chess, she was irritated by the empty display cabinet and the long gallery. "She finally solved the problem while strolling around a local car boot sale," said Max, "and at the same time changed the fortunes of so many people, myself included." Max stubbed out his second cigarette, and I was relieved that he didn't immediately roll another, as our little cell was fast coming to resemble Paddington Station in the era of the steam engine. Elsie was trudging around a car boot sale in Pudsey on a rainy Sunday morning. She only ever attended such events when it was raining, as that ensured fewer customers, and it was therefore easier for her to strike a bargain. She was rummaging through some clothes when she came across the chessboard. The red and white squares brought back memories of a photograph she had seen in the old Christie's catalogue, dating from when the original set had been sold. Elsie bargained for some time with the man standing at the back of an ancient Jaguar, and ended up having to part with £23 for the ivory chessboard. When Elsie returned to the hall, she placed the newly acquired board in the empty display cabinet, and was delighted to discover that it was a perfect fit. She thought nothing more of the coincidence until her Uncle Bertie advised her to have it valued, for insurance purposes, he explained. Unconvinced but unwilling to slight her uncle, Elsie took the board up to London on one of her monthly trips to visit her Aunt Gertrude. Lady Kennington, she was always Lady Kennington in London, dropped into Sotheby's on her way to Fortnum and Mason. A young assistant in the Chinese department asked if her ladyship would be kind enough to come back later that afternoon, by which time their expert would have placed a value on the board. Elsie returned to Sotheby's after a leisurely lunch with Aunt Gertrude. She was greeted by a Mr. Sensil, the head of the Chinese department, who offered the opinion that the piece was unquestionably Ming Dynasty. "And are you able to place a value on it?" She paused. "For insurance purposes." $2,000, $2,500, milady," said Mr. Sensil. "Ming chessboards are fairly common," he explained. "It is the individual pieces that are rare, and a complete set." He raised the palms of his hands and placed them together as if praying to the unseen god of auctioneers. "Are you perhaps considering selling the board?" he inquired. "No," replied Elsie firmly. "On the contrary, I'm thinking of adding to it." The expert smiled. After all, Sotheby's is nothing more than a glorified pawn shop, with each generation of the aristocracy either buying or selling. On arriving back at Kennington Hall, Elsie returned the board to its position of honour in the drawing-room. Aunt Gertrude set the ball rolling. On Christmas Day she presented her niece with a white pawn. Elsie placed the single piece on the empty board. It looked lonely. "And now, my dear, you must see if you can complete the set in your lifetime," the old lady challenged, unaware of the chain of events she was about to set in motion. What had begun as a whim while attending a car boot sale in Pudsey turned into an obsession as Elsie began to search the globe for the missing pieces. The first Lord Kennington would have been proud of her. When Lady Kennington gave birth to their first son, Edward, a grateful husband presented his wife with a white queen, a magnificently sculptured ivory lady adorned in a long, intricately carved royal gown. Her Majesty stared down with disdain on the single pawn. The next acquisition was another white pawn acquired by Uncle Bertie from a dealer in New York. This allowed the White Queen to reign over two of her subjects. The birth of a second son, James, was rewarded with a red bishop, resplendent in a flowing surplice and carrying a shepherd's crook. The Queen and her two subjects were now able to celebrate Holy Communion, even if they had to travel to the other side of the board to do so. Soon the whole family began to join in the search for the missing pieces. A red pawn was the next acquisition when it came under the auctioneer's hammer at Bonham's. He took up his place on the far side of the board, waiting to be taken. By now, everyone in the trade was only too aware of Lady Kennington's lifetime mission. Next to find his place on the board was a white castle, which Aunt Gertrude left Elsie in her will. In 1991, the 12th Lord Kennington passed away, by which time the white set was only lacking two pawns and a knight, while the red set was short of four pawns, one rook, and a king. On the 11th of May 1992, a dealer in possession of three red pawns and a white knight knocked on the door of Kennington Hall. He had recently returned from a journey through the outer regions of China, a long and arduous trek, he told her ladyship. But, he assured her, he had not returned empty-handed. Although her ladyship was in her declining years, she still held out for several days before the dealer finally settled his bill at the Kennington Arms and left, clutching a cheque for £26,000. Despite following up rumours from Hong Kong, flying to Boston, contacting dealers as far afield as Moscow and Mexico, rumour rarely became reality in Lady Kennington's unremitting search for the last of the missing pieces. During the next few years, Edward, the 13th Lord Kennington, came across the last red pawn and a red rook in the home of a penniless peer who had been on the same staircase as Eddie at Eton. His brother James, not to be outdone, acquired two white pawns from a dealer in Bangkok. This left only the Red King to be unearthed. The family had for some time been paying well over the odds for any missing pieces, since every dealer across the globe was well aware that if Lady Kennington was able to complete the set, it would be worth a fortune. When Elsie entered her ninth decade, she informed her sons that on her demise she planned to divide the estate equally between the two of them with one proviso. She intended to bequeath the chess set to whichever one of them found the missing Red King. Elsie died at the age of 83, without her king. Edward had already acquired the title, something you can't dispose of in a will, and now, after death duties, also inherited the hall and a further £857,000. James moved into the Cadogan Square apartment and also received the sum of £857,000. The Kennington set remained in its display case for all to admire, one square still unoccupied, ownership unresolved. Enter Max Glover. Max had one undisputed gift, his ability to wield a willow. Educated at one of England's minor public schools, his talent as a stylish left-handed batsman allowed him to mix with the very people that he would later rob. After all, a chap who can score an effortless half-century is obviously somebody one can trust. Away fixtures suited Max best, as they allowed him the opportunity to meet 11 potential new victims. Kennington Village 11 was no exception. By the time his lordship had joined the two teams for tea in the pavilion, Max had wormed out of the local umpire the history of the Kennington set, including the provision in the will that whichever son came up with a missing Red King would automatically inherit the complete set. Max boldly asked his lordship, while devouring a portion of Victoria Sponge, if he might be allowed to view the Kennington set, as he was fascinated by the game of chess. Lord Kennington was only too happy to invite a man with such an effortless cover drive into his drawing room. The moment Max spotted the empty square, a plan began to form in his mind. A few well-planted questions were indiscreetly answered by his host. Max avoided making any reference to his lordship's brother or the clause in the will. He then spent the rest of the afternoon at Square Leg, refining his plan. He dropped two catches. When the match was over, Max declined an invitation to join the rest of the team at the village pub, explaining that he had urgent business in London. Moments after arriving back at his flat in Hammersmith, Max phoned an old lag he'd shared a pad with when he'd been locked up in a previous establishment. The former inmate assured Max that he could deliver, but it would take him about a month and would cost him. Max chose a Sunday afternoon to return to Kennington Hall and continue his research. He left his ancient MG, soon to become a collector's item, he tried to convince himself, in the visitor's car park. He followed signs to the front door, where he handed over £5 in exchange for an entrance ticket. Maintenance and running costs had once again made it necessary for the hall to be open to the public at weekends. Max walked purposefully down a long corridor, adorned with ancestral portraits painted by such luminaries as Romney, Gainsborough, Lely, and Stubbs. Each would have fetched a fortune on the open market, but Max's eyes were set on a far smaller object, currently residing in the long gallery. When Max entered the room that displayed the Kennington set, he found the masterpiece surrounded by an attentive group of visitors who were being addressed by a tour guide. Max stood at the back of the crowd and listened to a tale he knew only too well. He waited patiently for the group to move on to the dining room and admire the family silver. "Several pieces were captured at the time of the Armada," the tour guide intoned, as the group followed him into an adjoining room. Max looked back down the corridor to check that the next group was not about to descend upon him. He placed a hand in his pocket and withdrew the Red King. Other than the colour, the intricately carved piece was identical in every detail to the White King standing on the opposite side of the board. Max knew the counterfeit would not pass a carbon dating test, but he was satisfied that he was in possession of a perfect copy. He left Kennington Hall a few minutes later and drove back to London. Max's next problem was to decide which city would have the most relaxed security to carry out his coup: London, Washington, or Peking. The People's Palace in Peking won by a short head. However, when it came to considering the cost of the whole exercise, the British Museum was the only horse left in the race. But what finally tipped the balance for Max was the thought of spending the next 5 years locked up in a Chinese jail, an American penitentiary, or residing at an open prison in the east of England. England won in a canter. The following morning, Max visited the British Museum for the first time in his life. The lady seated behind the information desk directed him to the back of the ground floor, where the Chinese collection is housed. Max discovered that hundreds of Chinese artifacts occupied the 15 rooms, and it took him the best part of an hour to locate the chess set. He had considered seeking guidance from one of the uniformed guards, but as he had no desire to draw attention to himself, and also doubted that they would be able to answer his question, he thought better of it. Max had to hang around for some time before he was left alone in the room. He could not afford a member of the public, or, worse, a guard, to witness his little subterfuge. Max noted that the security guard covered 4 rooms every 30 minutes. He would therefore have to wait until the guard had departed for the Islam room, while at the same time being sure that no other visitors were in sight before he could make his move. It was another hour before Max felt confident enough to take the bastard out of his pocket and compare the piece with the legitimate king standing proudly on its red square in the display cabinet. The two kings stared at each other, identical twins, except that one was an impostor. Max glanced around. The room was still empty. After all, it was 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, half-term, and the sun was shining. Max waited until the guard had moved on to Islamic artifacts before he carried out his well-rehearsed move. With the help of a Swiss army knife, he carefully prized open the lid of the display cabinet that covered the Chinese masterpiece. A raucous alarm immediately sounded, but long before the first guard appeared, Max had switched the two kings, replaced the cover of the case, opened a window, and strolled casually into the next room. He was studying the costume of a samurai when 2 guards rushed into the adjoining room. One cursed when he spotted the open window, while the other checked to see if anything was missing.
"Now, you'll want to know," suggested Max, clearly enjoying himself, "how I trapped both brothers into a fool's mate."
I nodded, but he didn't speak again until he'd rolled another cigarette.
"To start with," continued Max, "never rush a transaction when you're in possession of something two buyers want, and in this case desperately want. My next visit," he paused to light his cigarette, "was to a shop in the Charing Cross Road. This had not required a great deal of research because they advertised themselves in the Yellow Pages under chess as Marlowe's, the people who serve the masters and advise the beginners."
Max stepped into the musty old shop to be greeted by an elderly gentleman who resembled one of life's pawns, someone who took the occasional move forward, but still looked as if he must eventually be taken. Certainly not the type who reached the other side of the board to become a king. Max asked the old man about a chess set that he had spotted in the window. There then followed a series of well-rehearsed questions which casually led to the value of a red king in the Kennington set.
"Were such a piece ever to come onto the market?"
the elderly assistant mused.
"The price could be in excess of £50,000. As everyone knows, there are two certain bidders."
It was this piece of information that caused Max to make a few adjustments to his plan. His next problem was that he knew his bank account wouldn't stretch to a visit to New York. He ended up having to acquire several small objects from large houses which could be disposed of quickly so he could visit the States with enough capital to put his plan into effect. Luckily, it was in the middle of the cricket season. When Max landed at JFK, he didn't bother to visit Sotheby's or Christie's, but instead instructed the yellow cab to drive him to Phillips Auctioneers on East 79th Street. He was relieved to find that when he produced the delicate carving stolen from the British Museum, the young assistant didn't show a great deal of interest in the piece.
"Are you aware of its provenance?" asked the assistant.
"No," replied Max. "It's been in my family for years."
6 weeks later, a sales catalogue was published. Max was delighted to find that Lot 23 was listed as being of no known provenance, with a high value of $300. As it was not one of the items graced with a photograph, Max felt confident that few, if any, would take much interest in the Red King, and it would therefore be unlikely to come to the attention of either Edward or James Kennington. That is, until he made them aware of it. A week before the sale was due to take place, Max rang Phillips in New York. He had only one question for the young assistant, who replied that, although the catalogue had been available for over a month, no one had shown any particular interest in his Red King. Max feigned disappointment. The next call Max made was to Kennington Hall. He tempted his lordship with several ifs, buts, and even a maybe, which elicited an invitation to join Lord Kennington for lunch at White's. Lord Kennington explained to his guest over a bowl of brown Windsor soup that Max could not produce any papers over lunch as it was against the club rules. Max nodded, placed the Phillips catalogue under his chair, and began an elaborate tale of how, by sheer accident, while viewing the figure of a mandarin on behalf of a client, he had come across the Red King.
I would have missed it myself, said Max, if you hadn't acquainted me with its history.
Lord Kennington did not bother with pudding, bread and butter, cheese, cheddar, or biscuits, water, but suggested they took coffee in the library, where you are allowed to discuss business. Max opened the Phillips catalogue to reveal Lot 23, along with several loose photographs he had not shown the auctioneer. When Lord Kennington saw the estimate of $300, his next question was, "Do you think Phillips might have told my brother about the sale?"
"There is no reason to believe so," replied Max.
"I've been assured by one of the assistants working on the sale that the public have shown little interest in Lot 23.
"But how can you be so sure of its provenance?"
"That's what I do for a living," said Max with confidence.
But you can always have the piece carbon dated, and if I'm proved wrong, you won't have to pay for it.
Oh. Can't ask for more than that, said Lord Kennington.
So I suppose I'll have to fly to America and bid for the piece myself, he added, thumping the arm of the leather chair. A cloud of elderly dust rose into the air.
I wonder if that would be wise, my lord, said Max. After all...
And why not? Demanded Kennington.
It's just that if you were to fly to the States without explanation, it might arouse unnecessary curiosity among certain members of your family.
Max paused. And if you were then spotted in an auction house...
I take your point, said Kennington,
and looking across at Max, added, So, what do you advise, old boy?
I would be only too happy to represent your lordship's interests, said Max.
And what would you charge for such a service? Lord Kennington inquired.
£1,000 plus expenses, said Max, against 2.5% of the hammer price, which I can assure you is standard practice.
Lord Kennington removed his checkbook from an inside pocket and wrote out the figure £1,000.
How much do you estimate the piece might fetch? He asked casually.
Max was pleased that Lord Kennington had raised the subject of price, as it would have been his next question.
That will depend on whether anyone else is privy to our little secret, said Max. However, I would suggest that you place an upper limit of $50,000 on the piece.
$50,000? Spluttered Kennington in disbelief.
Hardly excessive, suggested Max, remembering that a complete set could fetch more than $1 million.
He paused. Or nothing, were your brother to acquire the Red King.
I take your point, repeated Kennington.
But you still might be able to pick it up for a few $100s.
Let's hope so, said Max.
Max Glover left White's Club a few minutes after 3, explaining to his host that he had another appointment that afternoon, which indeed he did. Max checked his watch and decided he still had enough time to stroll through Green Park and not be late for his next meeting. Max arrived in Sloane Square a few minutes before 4 and took a seat on a bench opposite the statue of Sir Francis Drake. He began to rehearse his new script. When he heard the clock on a nearby tower chime 4 times, he leapt up and walked briskly across to Cadogan Square. He stopped at number 16, climbed the steps, and rang the doorbell. James Kennington opened the door and greeted his guest with a smile.
I rang earlier this morning, explained Max. My name's Glover.
James Kennington ushered him through to the drawing room and offered Max a seat by an unlit fire. The younger brother took the seat opposite him. Although the apartment was spacious, even grand, there were one or two clear outlines on the walls to suggest where pictures had once hung. Max suspected that they were not being cleaned or reframed. Gossip columns regularly referred to the Honourable James's drinking habits and hinted at several unpaid gambling debts. When Max came to the end of his tale, he was well prepared for the Honourable James's first question.
How much do you imagine the piece will fetch, Mr. Glover?
A few $100s, Max replied.
That's assuming your brother doesn't find out about the auction.
He paused, sipped his tea, and added, In excess of 50,000, if he does.
But I don't have 50,000, said James.
Something else Max was well aware of.
And if my brother were to find out, James continued,
there would be nothing I could do about it. The terms of the will couldn't be clearer. Whoever finds the Red King inherits the set.
I'd be willing to put up the necessary capital to secure the peace, said Max, not missing a beat,
if, in turn, you would then agree to sell me the set.
And how much would you be willing to pay? Asked James.
$500,000, said Max.
But Sotheby's have already valued a complete set at over $1 million. Protested James.
That may well be the case, said Max, but $500,000 is surely better than nothing, which would be the outcome if your brother were to learn of the Red King's existence.
But you said that the Red King might sell for a few hundred,
in which case I would require only £1,000 in advance, against 2.5% of the hammer price, said Max for the second time that afternoon.
That's a risk I am quite willing to take, said James, with the smile of someone who believes he has gained the upper hand. If the Red King should sell for less than 50,000, he continued, I'd be able to raise the money myself. If it goes for more than 50,000, you can purchase the piece and I'll sell you the set for 500,000.
James sipped his tea before adding, I can't lose either way.
Neither can I, thought Max, as he extracted a contract from an inside pocket.
James read the document slowly. He looked up and said, You obviously felt confident that I would fall in with your plan, Mr. Glover.
If you hadn't, said Max.
My next visit would have been to your brother, which would have left you with nothing. At least now, to quote you, you can't lose either way.
Presumably I will have to travel to New York, said James.
Not necessary, replied Max. You can bid for the piece by phone, which has the added advantage that no one else will know who's on the other end of the line.
But how do I go about that? Asked James.
It couldn't be easier, Max assured him. The New York sale begins at 2 in the afternoon, which will be 7 o'clock in the evening in London. The Red King is lot 23, so I'll arrange for Phillips to place a call through to you once they reach lot 21. Just be sure you're sitting by the phone with no one else blocking the line.
And you'll take over if it goes above 50,000?
You have my word, said Max, looking him straight in the eye.
Max flew to New York the weekend before the sale was due to take place. He booked himself into a small hotel on the east side and settled for a room not much larger than our cell. But then he only had enough money left over to cover the end game. Max rose early on the Monday morning. He hadn't been able to sleep because of an orchestra of New York traffic and police sirens. He used the time to go over and over the different permutations that might occur once the sale began. He would be on center stage for less than 2 minutes, and, if he failed, would be back on the next plane to Heathrow with nothing to show for his efforts other than an overdrawn bank account. He grabbed a bagel on the corner of 3rd and 66th, before walking another few blocks to Phillips. He spent the rest of the morning at a manuscript sale that was being held in the room where the Chinese auction would take place. He sat silently at the back of the room, watching how the Americans conduct an auction, so that he wouldn't be wrong-footed later that afternoon. Max didn't eat any lunch, and not just because his meager funds were already stretched to their limit. Instead, he used the time to make 2 overseas calls. The first, to Lord Kennington, to confirm that he still had his authority to take the bidding for the Red King up to $50,000. Max assured him that the moment the hammer fell, he would call to let him know what sum the piece had sold for. A few minutes later, Max made a second call, this time to the Honourable James Kennington at his home in Cadogan Square. James picked up the phone after one ring, clearly relieved to hear Max's voice on the other end of the line. Max made the Honourable James Kennington exactly the same promise. Max replaced the phone and made his way across to the bidding counter, where he gave an assistant the details of James Kennington's telephone number in London and told her of his intention to bid for lot 23.
Leave it to us, sir, the assistant replied. I'll make sure we're in touch with him well in time.
Max thanked the assistant, made his way back to the sale room, and took his favoured place on the end of the 8th row, just to the right of the auctioneer. He began to turn the pages of the catalogue, checking on items in which he had no interest. While he sat around, impatiently waiting for the auctioneer to invite bids for lot number 1, he tried to work out who were the dealers, who the serious bidders, and who the simply curious. By the time the auctioneer climbed the steps of the rostrum at 2:05, the sale room was full of expectant faces. At 2 o'clock, the auctioneer smiled down at his clientele.
Lot number 1, he declared. A delicately crafted ivory fisherman.
The piece sold for $850, giving no hint of the drama that was about to follow. Lot 2 reached $1,000, but it wasn't until lot 17, the figure of a mandarin bent over a desk reading a ledger, that the $5,000 mark was achieved. One or two dealers, whose only interest was clearly in later lots, began to drift into the room, while a couple of others left, having failed or succeeded in acquiring the items they'd been after. Max could hear his heart pounding,
although it would still be some time before the auctioneer reached lot 23. He turned his attention to the row of phones on a long table by the side of the room. Only three were manned. When the auctioneer called lot 21, an assistant started to dial. A few moments later, she cupped a hand over the mouthpiece and began to whisper. When lot 22 was offered, she spoke briefly to her client again. Max assumed that she must be warning James Kennington that the Red King would be the next item to come under the hammer.
"Lot 23, declared the auctioneer, glancing down at his notes. "An exquisitely carved Red King, provenance unknown. Do I have an opening bid of $300?
Max raised his catalogue.
$500?
Inquired the auctioneer, turning to face the assistant on the phone. She whispered into the mouthpiece and then nodded firmly. The auctioneer turned his attention back to Max, who had raised his catalogue even before a price had been suggested.
"I have a bid of $1,000, said the auctioneer, returning to face the telephone bidder.
$2,000, he ventured, surprised to see the assistant nod so quickly.
$3,000,
he suggested as he looked back at Max. The catalogue shot up again, and several dealers at the back of the room began chatting amongst themselves.
$4,000,
inquired the auctioneer, staring in disbelief at the assistant on the phone. $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, and $10,000 were overtaken in less than a minute. The auctioneer tried desperately to look as if this was exactly what he had anticipated as the murmurs in the room grew louder and louder. Everyone seemed to have an opinion. One or two dealers abandoned their favoured places and quickly walked to the back of the room, hoping to find an explanation for the bidding frenzy. Some were already beginning to make assumptions, but were in no position to bid under such pressure, especially as the amounts were now going up in leaps of $5,000. Max raised his catalogue in response to the auctioneer's inquiry.
$45,000? Are you bidding $50,000?
He inquired of the lady on the telephone. Everyone in the room turned to see how she would respond. For the first time, she hesitated. The auctioneer repeated,
$50,000?
She whispered the figure into the phone, and after a long pause, nodded, but not quite so enthusiastically. When Max was offered the piece for $55,000, he also hesitated, taking his time before he finally raised his catalogue.
$60,000,
suggested the auctioneer to the assistant on the phone. Max waited nervously as she cupped her hand over the mouthpiece and repeated the figure. Beads of sweat began to appear on Max's forehead as he wondered if James Kennington had managed to raise more than $50,000, in which case he would just about clear his expenses on the whole exercise. After what seemed like an eternity, but was in fact only 20 seconds, the assistant shook her head. She put the phone down. When the auctioneer smiled in Max's direction and said,
"Sold to the gentleman on my left for $55,000,
Max felt sick, triumphant, dazed, and relieved, all at the same time. Max remained in his place as he waited for the furore to die down. After a dozen more lots had been disposed of, he slipped quietly out of the room, unaware of the suspicious stares from dealers who wondered who he was. He strolled across the thick green carpet and stopped at the purchasing counter.
"I wish to leave a deposit on lot 23.
The clerk looked down at her list. "A Red King?" she said, and double-checked the price.
$55,000, she added, and looked up at Max for confirmation.
He nodded as the assistant began to fill in the little boxes on the purchasing document. A few moments later, she swiveled the form round for Max to sign.
"That will be $5,500 deposit," she said, "and the full amount must be settled within 28 days.
Max nodded nonchalantly, as if this was a procedure he was well familiar with. He signed the agreement and then wrote out a check for $5,500, aware that it would empty his account. He pushed it across the counter. The assistant handed him back the top copy of the agreement and retained the duplicate. When she checked the signature, she hesitated. It might have been a coincidence. After all, Glover was a common enough name. She didn't want to insult a customer, but she knew she would have to report the anomaly to their compliance department before they could consider cashing the check. Max left the auction house and headed north to Park Avenue. He strode confidently into Sotheby Park Burnett and approached the reception desk. He asked if he could have a word with the head of the Oriental Department. He was kept waiting for only a few minutes. On this occasion, Max didn't waste time with any preliminary questions that would have only been a smokescreen to disguise his true intent. After all, as the sales clerk at Phillips had pointed out, he only had 28 days to complete the transaction. Should the Kennington chess set come onto the market, what would you expect it to fetch? Max asked. The expert looked incredulous, although he had already been briefed on the sale of the Red King at Phillips and on the price the piece had fetched.
750,000, possibly as much as 1 million, came back the reply. And if I was able to deliver the Kennington set and you were in a position to authenticate it, what amount would Sotheby's be willing to advance against a future sale? 400,000, possibly 5, if the family were able to confirm that it was the Kennington set. I'll be in touch, promised Max. All his immediate and long-term problems solved.
Max checked out of his little hotel on the east side later that evening and took a taxi to Kennedy Airport. Once the plane had taken off, he slept soundly for the first time in days. The 727 touched down at Heathrow just as the sun was rising over the Thames. Having nothing to declare, Max took the Heathrow Express to Paddington and was back in his flat in time for breakfast. He began to fantasize about what it would be like to dine regularly at his favorite restaurant and always